A federal judge has sentenced former Pennsylvania Congressman Shaka Fatah to 10 years in prison for orchestrating what prosecutors call a white-collar crime spree. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. The 60-year-old, along with his co-defendants, was also ordered to pay more than $600,000 in restitution for his crimes, which includes stealing public funds to help repay part of an illegal loan made to Fatah's failed bid for Philadelphia mayor in 2007, as well as using campaign cash to help his son pay off some of his college loan debt. Joining me now is WHYY reporter Aaron Mozell, who covered Fatah's legal problems from his indictment through sentencing. Aaron, I'm interested in knowing what Fatah had to say in court today.
Yeah, I think we all were. Fatah briefly addressed Judge Harvey Bartle, who's presided over all of these proceedings before he was sentenced. He didn't get into a lot of the specifics about the crimes he was convicted of. He just mentioned that he personally regretted some of the decisions he made. And the rest of the time he spent talking about how proud he was of the work he did during his two decades in Congress, specifically how many people he felt the work had helped over the years, millions by his count. And through it all, Fatah sounded like he has at any public event you may have caught him at during his career. He was calm, he was confident, he was proud. After the hearing, he did also address reporters, only really to say that he respects the court's decision and to thank his family, supporters, and of course his lawyers.
Fatah's sentencing came across before the noon hour, and then subsequent to that, we learned more about his co-defendant, Herb Viderman.
Right. So Herb Viderman is a former deputy mayor of Philadelphia. He worked under Ed Rendell when he was in City Hall. He got 2 years in prison and a $50,000 fine for his crimes, which tie back to bribing Fatah over a period of years, principally as part of this effort to become a U.S. ambassador under the Obama administration. In one instance, perhaps probably the most noteworthy, Viderman gives Fatah $18,000 to help him purchase a vacation home in the Poconos. In exchange, Fatah wrote letters extolling Viderman's resume. He sends them to Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Bob Casey and members of the Obama administration. The rest of the case's co-defendants will be sentenced tomorrow and Wednesday. They include Bonnie Bowser. She's a former chief of staff at Fatah's congressional office. Kara Nicholas. She's a former congressional staffer as well and a CEO of the Educational Advancement Alliance, this nonprofit that Fatah founded. And Robert Brand, who ran a company called Solutions for Progress. That's a for-profit company. And I name those because Fatah used those two organizations to help funnel those stolen public funds back to the lender of that illegal campaign loan, which sat at the heart of this case.
Take us back to Fatah's former district for a reaction there.
Sure. So Fatah's old district, just for anyone who doesn't know, the second congressional district covers parts of North, Northwest, and West Philly. It also has a chunk of Lower Marion Township, most of it in Montgomery County, I should say. There are certainly voters across the district who are writing off Fatah because of his convictions. They just can't support him because of it. But there are also a number of voters, especially in West Philly, which is widely considered the heart of his district, who say Fatah's legacy is safe with them despite his crimes. Some of the reasons, as you expect, have to do with his 11 terms in Congress, in particular the millions he sent back to the district, whether it was for transportation projects, brain research, college readiness programs. But others speak more to Fatah's personal narrative. Fatah grew up in a rough neighborhood in West Philly where gang violence was routine. And sort of that idea of someone like him going on to the halls of Congress, people told me that means a lot to neighbors. One longtime family friend told me Fatah was like their knight in shining armor.
Looking to the calendar, what's next?
Fatah is scheduled to self-surrender, turn himself into authorities on January 25th. His lawyers are expected to file a lengthy appeal at some point afterwards. It's worth noting that Fatah's sentence would be the longest, or is the longest, I'm sorry, handed to a congressman convicted of corruption.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
WHYY's Aaron Mozell on Newsworks Tonight. In response to a spike in overdose deaths across the region, Bucks County is trying to make it easier to get the overdose-reversing drug naloxone. WHYY's Alana Gordon offers this report on the first day of a new walk-in initiative.
Bucks County has experienced more than 100 overdose deaths this year. That's troubling to Diane Rosati, longtime head of the county's Drug and Alcohol Commission. Her office is in Warminster, in a one-story brick building near a school, a retirement community, an auto shop, and some big box stores.
Certainly in Bucks County, we find ourselves geographically within the perfect storm of neighboring Philadelphia, whose heroin is among the least expensive, where purity is among the highest, as well as Allentown and Trenton. So we're in a corridor where it is so easily accessible.
In the last couple weeks, reports of several more overdose deaths in a short period of time prompted her office to try something new. They've set up walk-in hours where people can stop in for a private one-on-one meeting with prevention specialist Mallory Showalter. There, she'll train people in how to use naloxone.
We certainly want everyone to feel comfortable, very comfortable using this medication when they leave this office. That's, I think, our number one goal.
Showalter says naloxone can be life-saving because in those critical moments before help arrives, it can reverse a potentially fatal overdose. The Bucks County office is giving them out for free. Rosati, the director, wasn't sure how this first day of walk-ins would go and whether anyone would show up. They did.
And at some point during this morning, all four of us were busy with community residents.
More than a dozen people came in.
The majority of folks happen to have children, adult children, who have an addiction to opiates and an overriding concern of just wanting to make sure that they support them, provide the resources, and have something to save their lives.
Rosati's office plans to continue the walk-ins indefinitely on Monday and Tuesday mornings. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
As President-elect Donald Trump assembles his cabinet and advisors, commentator Solomon Jones worries his choice signals a step back in the struggle for equal rights.
We cannot allow bigotry to become the new normal in America. Not in the country where African Americans continue to fight for the freedoms our founding documents so readily conferred upon others. Not in the country where the blood of my ancestors soaks the southern soil they farmed without recompense. Not in the country that had seemingly come so far on race. Yet here we are. In the wake of Donald Trump's victory, signs of the new normal continue to surface. The new normal is the march of hooded Klansmen hailing Trump's election in a North Carolina town. The new normal is Steve Bannon, a hero to the white nationalist movement, being installed as the president-elect's chief strategist. The new normal is a media trying to reflect a society that seems to be regressing. That reality hit me hard this weekend when the Washington Post reported that the Cast Station, a TV and film commercial casting company, had put out a call for any and all real alt-right thinkers, believers. The company said it was looking to cast a Cadillac advertisement that would be a beautifully artistic spot that's capturing all walks of life of America. When Reuters and other outlets reported on the notice, the casting company fired the employee responsible, and Cadillac said it did not authorize or approve a casting notice for an alt-right neo-Nazi role in a commercial. As a black man living in the midst of this new normal, I now know that America is a place it was not just a few weeks ago. It is a place where a casting agency would publicly call for white nationalists to help advertise an iconic American brand and tell us it is meant to be beautiful. In this new normal, racism, or as Cadillac's statement rightly called it, a neo-Nazi belief system, is becoming acceptable. And unless Americans of all stripes rise up against it, a media anxious to reflect its customer base will thrust bigotry into the mainstream. We've seen it happen before. In early American ads, blacks were portrayed with characteristics drawn straight from minstrel shows. Popular brand symbols such as Uncle Ben, Rastus, the cream of wheat chef, and Aunt Jemima were derived directly from slavery. Asian Americans were often depicted in advertisements with long braided hair and eating live rats while gleefully washing people's clothes. When film came along, the images of black men as dangerous brutes, as in the Ku Klux Klan-inspired Birth of a Nation, were so effective that Klan membership increased exponentially. So did lynching. And as this year's Oscars So White controversy showed, the film industry often continues to ignore non-whites. Against the backdrop of that history, we find ourselves in this moment. It is a moment when the president-elect is preparing to take office on a platform that castigates ethnic, racial, and religious minorities. It is a moment when those who hold bigoted views feel empowered to act upon them. It is a moment when Americans must stand up and say, "This is not normal. Not in advertising, not in real life, not at all." I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. The search is on for new sources of clean energy, and one place to find it could be the Ohio River. The Ohio and its tributaries could become a hotspot for new hydropower development using the region's extensive network of navigation dams. Though, as the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains, not everyone wants to take the hydro plunge.
Behind a chain-link fence, Paul Jacob watches water spill over a dam on Neville Island on the Ohio River near Pittsburgh.
Our project will be just in the water.
The water forms a white froth at the base of the dam, called the Emsworth Back Channel, before flowing into the brown waters of the Ohio. To Jacob, that froth looks like opportunity.
If you look out and you'll see all the water that's flowing over that dam, that basically is unused energy.
Jacob is with Rye Development, a company that's proposed building a small hydropower plant at Emsworth and 9 other dams in western Pennsylvania and West Virginia. If approved, the projects could come online by 2019. Emsworth is part of the Army Corps of Engineers' extensive system of dams along the Ohio and Mississippi River systems. And from Jacob's perspective, these rivers contain a wealth of untapped power.
It's wasted energy that's created by the fact that you've got a substantial flow of water and the difference in elevation of the water. What we do is capture that in a turbine, so it basically spins a giant turbine relatively slowly, and then that spins a generator, and that produces the electricity.
The amount of energy these projects can create isn't enormous. The Emsworth Dam could power only 6,000 to 12,000 homes. That's a tiny fraction compared to the million or so homes a big coal-fired power plant or a hydro plant at Niagara Falls can produce. But even at this scale, these projects can benefit the economy and the environment, Jacob says.
It's a carbon-free resource. So once this is built, it'll just operate. The life of these projects is extremely long compared to most other resources. So it makes a good contribution in terms of adding a renewable resource that's also available on a 24/7 basis.
That last part is important. Wind and solar don't always produce electricity when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. So adding reliable sources of power is a big push for people trying to get more renewables onto the grid. Fast-growing wind and solar may garner a lot of attention, but hydropower is still the biggest source of renewable energy in the country, accounting for 7% of all electricity in the U.S.
Often it's talked about as the silent renewable.
David Zayas is with the National Hydropower Association. He says hydropower has been around for so long, some people assume there's no room for it to grow. But the Department of Energy says the industry could grow by 50% over the next 3 decades.
You know, the myth of that hydropower is all tapped out, and that, you know, I think Pennsylvania is a really good example of that not being the case.
With its plentiful rainfall and dammed up rivers, the Keystone State is well suited for hydropower development, says Lindsay Baxter of the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. She says hydro also fits well with what a modernized grid will look like.
The future of power generation is going to be more distributed, smaller resources that are very low or no carbon emitting. And hydro feeds into that and could be very complementary to some of the other resources like wind and solar.
Baxter's group is pushing for more hydropower, but it doesn't want big new dams that can wipe out habitat or displace homes and businesses. Instead, Baxter thinks building projects onto existing dams makes the most sense.
That's really where we see more of the opportunity, where you have a previously disturbed environment. Sometimes those can be retrofitted to produce power with very little or no impacts on the environment.
Actually, some worry new hydropower plants, even on existing dams, could be bad for rivers. On a recent afternoon, Rob Walters took me on a cruise up the Allegheny River, a few miles from where it flows into the Ohio.
A few times a year, and there is one guy fishing.
Over there?
No, over here to the left, see the white.
Walters is with Three Rivers Waterkeeper. The group monitors water quality on Pittsburgh's rivers, which have slowly seen fish populations increase after decades of industrial pollution. We're idling just below the Highland Park Dam, the site of one of Rye Development's proposed hydroelectric projects. He says this is one of the best spots on the river to fish.
Why are the fish there and not just, like, I don't know, in the middle of the river?
The dissolved oxygen. There's more oxygen concentrated at the dam. It's turbulent.
The dam acts like one of those aerators in an aquarium, infusing the water in this section of the river or pool with oxygen, feeding plants, fish, and other wildlife. A hydropower plant would funnel some of the turbulent water into turbines instead of letting it tumble over the dam, State and federal wildlife agencies say this could drop the river's oxygen levels, which already run low during the summer.
Maybe not specifically in one pool, but the cumulative impact we're talking about, basically every lock and dam on the Monongahela River, the Ohio River, there already is one up on the Allegheny River at the moment. This would be another one.
The developer will need to negotiate with the Corps of Engineers over how much river flow and dissolved oxygen it can divert for the project. But Walters says oxygen isn't all that worries him. He points to a spit of rocks just below the dam. A man sits there on a portable chair. Next to him, a cooler, a bait bucket, and a fishing rod. Walters is worried this spot could get taken out by the hydropower plant, though he doesn't know what the final plan will look like.
To the gentleman that's up there, yeah, definitely looks like he's doing a little catfishing. This is his Yosemite. And why should we take that away from him? And he should have a voice in saying that, you know, every Tuesday afternoon he comes down here with his kids or his grandkids or by himself and he fishes and catches catfish and maybe he takes one home and he eats it.
Walter says he's in favor of clean energy, but he doesn't want it to come at the cost of the region's still recovering rivers and those who use them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
That story is part of the Allegheny Front series, Headwaters, Exploring the Ohio River, in partnership with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Turns out the phrase, this package sold by weight, not by volume, applies to Milky Ways, even the ones beyond our galaxy. Let's investigate truth in advertising with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, we're going on a trip some 300 light years out.
Yes, and we chose the 300 light years out because this is an interesting cluster of galaxies for us to observe for many reasons, but what we're talking about are what astronomers are beginning to describe as either dark galaxies or ultra-diffuse galaxies. Now, when we think about galaxies, Dave, we always consider that these are collections of hundreds of millions or billions of stars all held together by gravity. In this particular instance of ultra-diffuse or dark galaxies, we're talking about galaxies that seem to have the same mass as normal galaxies, but only 1 to 10% of the number of stars. And that's really strange. So, for example, in one of these particular galaxies called Dragonfly 44, it's about the same mass as our Milky Way galaxy, but it just doesn't have the 300 to 400 billion stars that our Milky Way galaxy has. And astronomers have no answers to these questions yet because this is such a new observation. Although the numbers of galaxies like this has begun to increase dramatically from one just a few years ago to easily over 1,500 now, with more to be discovered as astronomers continue to survey around the universe.
This notion, this nomenclature, dark matter, implies something in our universe that we can't detect yet. But if and when that time comes, would it then be inappropriate to refer to it as such? It would just be another known component.
Well, we have this great placeholder, that great mystery name of dark matter. I'd like to think of this particular example as being something from the we don't know everything department.
From dark matter to too much light, reflecting off the moon, keeping us from really enjoying the Geminid meteor shower this week.
Yeah, the major meteor shower of the year, the Geminid meteor shower that can show us up to 120 meteors per hour under dark, clear skies. These are bright and often quite intensely colored, but that all goes to the side when we have a full moon interfering, and that's the case here. The moon will be rising as the sun sets, so the sky is dark all night. The meteors will be around for a few days, but we still have the moon as a situation. It doesn't mean we won't see any. It's that we won't see the fainter ones of this shower. We'll see the bright ones of this shower. So this is the kind of observing event that requires observers to be outside for a length of time, preferably with a group of friends and some other entertainment of music or a glass of wine, observing the sky to see if you can see any anywhere around the sky, because they can appear almost anywhere. They may seem to emanate from the constellation Gemini, hence the name Geminid. But again, this would be the best shower of the year, so the brighter members could be seen. Even in an urban environment, the brightest of them would be seen.
And if that wine is best savored in small sips over a period of time, what else is there to be seen in the night sky this week?
Well, while you're out, if you go out just after sunset, over in the southwestern portion of the sky, two bright planets, Venus, the brighter of the two, and Mars. It's great to have a look at Mars these days. You can consider that there are rovers up there working all the time to help us answer questions about life in the solar system, possibly. And then if you're a morning person, prior to 7 a.m., now you can actually see the largest planet of our solar system, Jupiter. It's there and available for view. And last but not least, sunsets will start to come later, beginning later this week. By the end of this month, we'll have an additional 10 minutes on sunset time.
Wow, not even winter yet.
Heading towards spring, as I love to say.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up with